Okay, today is February 25th, 2015. This is the second interview with Thomas Archdeacon. Again, we're here in his office inside the Mossy Humanities Building. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. As with last time, if we could get you to say your name and spell your last name.
Thomas Archdeacon, A-R-C-H-D-E-A-C-O-N.
That looks great.
Okay.
So this time we're going to focus, at least start our focus on your military experience. And so my first question is, from your CV, I see that you joined the reserves in 64.
Well, I had an ROTC obligation. Okay. So I was in ROTC in college. I graduated in 64, and then I received a series of deferments to go to graduate school.
So I know from others that I've talked to that ROTC was something you just did when you were in college in the 50s and 60s. Was that the case with you?
Yes, I would say I had I'm not a big person for going to reunions, but a friend of mine twisted my arm a bit, and I went to my 40th college reunion. That would have been back in 2004. And it surprised me how many of the people with whom I had gone to school had served in the military, mostly by virtue of ROTC. And, you know, when I sort of compare that with how many people I had met in the rest of my life, which was mostly involved in academics, who had been in the military, you know, it just sort of reminded me of the thing. It was not untypical at all. Now, when I take a look at the ROTC program we have at UW here, and the number of students we have, you know, it's probably, I think at my school, in my college, pardon me, I think we had around 500 people in the graduating class. Here we probably have about 5,000 people in the graduating class, and they probably commission in a given year half the number of people that were commissioned at my time. And I think that's more a comparison of the times than of the schools per se. It was a kind of routine thing to do, and part of that may have been the existence of the draft. You were at a higher risk of being called, and you might as well be called in a capacity commensurate with your training or whatever, or some sense of maybe it's a mini-max kind of strategy that you recognize that you were going to lose some time, but you would try to use it in the most maximally effective way, both for yourself and for the country, if you want, by, you know, agreeing to serve on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and then, you know, there's all kinds of political events that have happened between the 60s and now that have changed attitudes and the like.
Can you remind me, I know it's in your CV, where did you go to college?
No, at Fordham University in New York. That's in New York City in the Bronx.
So by the time, when you're in ROTC, this is the early to mid-60s?
Yeah, 1960 to 64,
okay.
So
Cold War.
Cold War era rather than Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Vietnam was just beginning to heat up. I mean, Bay of Tonkin incident isn't until 1964 even, so that's kind of a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were scatterings of advisors in Laos and in Vietnam before that, but there was no real substantial U.S. military presence in U.S. military units rather than as attachment to RVN units or whatever.
So when you're in graduate school at Columbia, right?
Yes.
You're in the reserves at that time?
I'm in the reserves, but I'm not doing anything in effect.
Mm-hmm. So is it not even the, from what I know of the reserves, at least sort of in the more present day that you would do, like, or maybe that's the guard. So you didn't have, did you have to go to any sort of...
No, I didn't have to go anything. At that point, it was a... the balance of forces was somewhat different back then, in the sense that it was the regular army that really carried everything, and the idea of reserve units or guard units being called up was pretty uncommon. I mean, some had been called up at the time of the Berlin Wall crisis and 1961, but the idea of like reserve units in Vietnam or any place like that, or reservists being sent as advisors, even more so, that just wasn't done at that point. This question of the, you know, the use of the reserve forces, reserve units sort of being constantly activated, this has really been a post end of the draft kind of program of the military rather than anything before that. In fact, in certain ways, getting into the reserve was a way of avoiding Vietnam for many people. Now, in the case of ROTC people, that wasn't the case. I mean, there you knew that you would do 2 years on active duty, and then in theory you even had a couple of more years of reserve duty after that that might require some meetings or not. Mm-hmm. But the officers were going to do 2 years of active duty. For others, I mean, and it depended really much on the case, a reserve or a National Guard appointment could be a way of sort of avoiding service in the active army. And if you avoided service in the active, or the active, name your branch. Mm-hmm. And if you avoided that service, then you avoided going overseas too. So it was a very it was a different kind of dynamic, really.
Mm-hmm. Maybe only partially related question then, but so you're in the reserves, even though sort of the reserves as they are in the 60s are different. But you're in the reserves at Columbia during a time, from what I know, is a very sort of, well, hot time for student protest and anti-Vietnam. Yeah.
Increasingly so. 65, not some, 65 just beginning, by 68 obviously is a campus, maybe not obviously, but in 68 there's a campus takeover and protest of the war.
So as a graduate student, were you involved in the anti-war protests in any way?
No, not really. I mean, I was not. I was very ambivalent about the war, but I'm not a person who gets involved very much in demonstrations, even for things about which I care deeply. But also, I think it would have been inappropriate for me to be involved in that. I wasn't speaking out in behalf of the war. I wasn't active in opposition to the war. I was just a graduate student. Mm-hmm. And probably most people were just graduate students at the time too.
Mm-hmm. So when you I assume you get your degree in 69, and that's when you
go. Well, no, actually I get my degree in 71, although I had sort of broken the back of the program by 69. Mm-hmm. And decided it was time to go.
So active duty. So you were going to have to do 2 years
active duty.
And so you started in 69.
Right.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind maybe giving if you can, an overview of those couple years of active duty, and then I might ask some follow up.
Okay.
Questions.
Well, I mean, it was strange in a way. I was commissioned in what's called the Adjutant General's Corps of the Army, which is an administrative branch, sometimes referred to, in a term that had more relevance than a Remington Raider, referring to the Remington typewriters, you know, that had a kind of Captain America shield as its emblem, the red and white stripes and things, and known as the Shield of Shame, and because it was a non-combat branch, basically. So I was headed off into that, and something very strange happened. West Point, the United States Military Academy, had been under review by, I forget what it's Middle States something or other. It's the accrediting body that examines colleges on the middle portion of the eastern coast of the United States. And the accrediting body had some problem because U.S. history was not taught at West Point. They had this attitude, well, you studied U.S. history in high school, theoretically. I mean, they're working on a pretty shaky model of what was being done in high schools. And then you'd study European history in college to get a broader perspective. And the one course they had was a course on U.S. foreign policy, USFOR, History of U.S. Foreign Policy. They called it, they have acronyms for everything. So Middle States wanted them to teach more American history. Now, the way that West Point recruited faculty was that they would look for Army officers who had been in the field for a number of years, 5, 6, 7 years, who either in college or subsequently had examined or exhibited academic talent. And then they'd offer them the prospect of going to graduate school, usually for 2 years, and then come back for a period of 3 years and teach at West Point, and then go back and resume their Army careers. Mm-hmm. And that meant that they had a constantly rotating faculty with people constantly in the pipeline to come on board. But the problem happened that they had nobody in the pipeline to teach American history, and they needed to get people quickly. And so they picked up really 4 of us that year. 3 of us out of ROTC, and one fellow who had been drafted and went through OCS, Officers Candidate School. And they brought us to West Point. Now, I think part of the reason that I might have been included in that was they knew me at West Point ever so slightly, in that some of the people who were coming on to teach or had been coming on to teach, I had met when they were graduate school students at Columbia. Hmm. So I have no idea whether this is true or not. Pardon me. But I can imagine that names may have been bouncing around, and they're saying, oh, there's some guy who's going on active duty from ROTC this year. His name's Archdeacon. And somebody might have raised their hand and said, oh, well, we know him. He's, you know, down at Columbia. He's doing American history. He's okay. You know, I don't know. But it might have been that way. But one way or the other, they had me come on duty. The one thing with which they were dissatisfied was that I was in the Adjutant General's Corps, and they wanted me trained in a combat arm instead. So instead of going to Adjutant General School, I went to Armor School at Fort Knox before going to West Point, and so my military occupation, I had two military occupational specialties, MOSs they're called. One was a 1203, which is tank unit commander, and the other was 2701. And that's an instructor in non-military topics. So that was kind of unusual. I continued to wear adjutant general brass and the like. They didn't make me transfer branch. But in effect, my training was in a combat army. Mm-hmm. And since everybody who graduated from West Point was graduating into a combat arm, they didn't send anyone to non-combat sectors of the Army. I can see their logic. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the people I was teaching with were not only in combat arms, but they had been in combat. They had been in Vietnam at least once, maybe twice. So, they were trying to give me some kind of credibility among the students, mm-hmm. as well as, however, a minor taste of the real side of the Army.
So how long were you at Fort Knox?
About 3 months or so.
And they felt that was a sufficient...
Well, I completed what's called Armor Officer's Basic Course. You stop this for a second.
Yep. Okay, so I want to ask a hopefully quick question here. So when I've interviewed veterans in other places, one of the questions that comes up is about, you know, their boot camp experience. Did you have like a boot camp experience at any point during?
Well, I think the boot camp experience comes as part of ROTC. There's a summer, as it was organized then, it was a 4-year program, and between your third and fourth year, you had the equivalent of a boot camp. This was, you know, the thing I went to, I don't want to say boot camp light. I mean, it was realistic and you were doing things, but it wasn't the kind of thing where they attempt to break you down in order to build you back up sort of thing. It was more a question of soon you're going to have professional responsibilities, and these are things that you have to know, and here's how you do it kind of stuff. So it was pretty realistic. And it was very realistic. You're riding around in tanks, learning about tactics, firing tank weaponry, doing, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. It was it was serious in that regard, but it was at a mature level where you were you were learning stuff that you needed to know in a way that it was not character building so much as it was practical mm-hmm. knowledge.
So once you got done with Fort Knox, did you then join the faculty at West Point?
Yeah, I came up right away to West Point.
So you said U.S. history, but specifically what were you teaching then?
Well, the first year, they had me teaching European history because they had just, I think, one or two sections of U.S. history. They were rolling it out a little bit more slowly than I thought. And another fellow was teaching that, and so I taught European history. But then the next 2 years, I taught American history. There was a time I taught urban history. It was mostly like American history I was teaching, because I spent there 3 years instead of two, actually.
So why did it end up being 3 years instead of?
Well, It was a combination. The normal tour at West Point was 3 years. So they thought in terms of people doing a 3-year teaching tour. So that was it. But they had me as a 2-year person. So they were interested in my doing 3 years. I didn't mind it there, in terms of my own interest in finishing the dissertation and establishing myself, spending an extra year there made sense. The one hang-up was that in order to do that, I was what was called an OBV2, Obligated Volunteer 2 years. And in order to stay for a third year, I'd have to change my status to that, to one called Voluntary Indefinite. That basically took the option to leave out of my hands and gave it to the military's hands. And I was somewhat skittish about that, given that everybody knew that Vietnam was going south really fast at by this point. And I was given assurances that it would be okay, and indeed, perhaps in one of the more, I don't know, odd or humorous moments, there was this general named Piers, who at the time was a very famous man, I think it was P-I-E-R-S, who wrote the Piers Report on the Voluntary Army. And Piers was up there at West Point and took me aside and told me that he'd give his word that the Army wouldn't keep me before beyond a third year if I stayed. And I accepted his word, and he was good to it. Now, several years later, I was back at West Point on a kind of reserve thing where I'd go for a couple of weeks in the summer, and I was over at a friend's house, and he had another guy was, I don't know, I think the man was stationed there at that point, but he was at his house for whatever reason, and he was from the Adjutant General's Corps, and while I had been at West Point, he had been down at Washington, and he told me how frustrating I was for the Adjutant General's Corps, because they were ticked off that I hadn't gone to AG school, and they were ticked off that I was getting out of Vietnam, and they were desperate to get their hands on me, and they couldn't. So I guess I was wise to get Piers's word on this. I mean, it was all fun and games at that point. We were all laughing about it, but I suppose a few years before, he might not have been laughing about it when he had a different role.
Right. So were these U.S. History Survey courses?
Yeah. One of them was a course in U.S. Urban History I taught 1 year, but it was, you know, basically U.S. Survey. Now, they also, I should mention this, they always had courses like they had courses in what they called military art or military history. And those would sort of be a survey of warfare from the time of the Romans up to the present. And so U.S. history, insofar as you had military history, would have been taught in that guise. And it was a rather strange arrangement, because when I first went up to West Point, I was a member of what was called the Social Sciences or the Social Studies Department. Social Sciences Department, I guess it was called. Department of Social Sciences. And that department basically housed history, political science, and economics. Those were the thing. I've often Yeah, those, that was it. I think it might have been somewhat modeled on Oxford with the roads of, you know, you major in PP&E, politics, philosophy, and economics, instead of philosophy, they had history or something.
Mm-hmm.
There was the social science department, and civilian history, non-military history, was based in social science department. But after the first year I was there, they rearranged it, and they moved the historians all the way over, not all the way over, it was just a matter of moving down the hall. They moved them to the military history department, which then just became the history department, and taught both civilian and military history. So I was actually a member of two departments during my time there. The civilian historians, especially those of us who were not career or army, were a little bit wary about going down to the military history department, or military art, because they were supposed to be more hard-nosed guys and less sympathetic, and kind of the social science department had the reputation of being, thinking the big thoughts and like, and being more open-minded. And the social science department was, it was a very good department. They had some really strong people there, people who would go far in the army. It was a very, it was a department with a long history of producing important leaders. But we went down there, and actually the transition wasn't too bad. The man who was the commander or the head of the department down in the military art, he was a very strong kind of guy, Tom Gries, G-R-I-E-S-S, and he sort of, you know, he said this integration of the two sides will work, and accordingly it
mm-hmm.
did work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there really wasn't, and the people down there were absolutely fine too. They were a little bit, some of them were a little bit more uptight than were the social science people, but for the most part they were fine.
And did you think about the time at the time, or reflect upon that, you know, you were there from 69 to 72 teaching at the military academy when, you know, a lot of other academic places were sort of roiling in the anti-war movement. I wonder if you've thought of that, ever thought of that?
Oh, yeah, no, I thought about it a lot of time. And I was ambivalent there at times because I was teaching young men who, if the war had gone on, would undoubtedly have ended up in Vietnam. Now, I'm not so sure how many of them actually did, because, let's say, certainly people that I taught my first year there probably did. The people who graduated in 72, I imagine some of them did, but maybe not all of them, because, you know, the commitment was going down over time. So I had, you know, it was a sense of responsibility. You wanted to answer serious questions seriously, but you didn't want to jeopardize these people by, you know, at least in my mind, I didn't want to, surely wasn't going to be calling them baby killers or anything of that nature. You know, they were people who were going to do a job and maybe be called in awkward situations, and try to treat them with respect. You know, they're undergraduates, but still treat them with respect, recognizing what they have. Now, the thing you have to recognize about West Point is that it's probably not the way you think it was. There were, especially in the social science department, there were officers there who had anti-war posters up. Probably half the department was opposed to the war. And there was never any problem about that. Yeah, I think the thing that made it a little bit different in that way, it was sort of, you know, my thing. If they had ordered me to go, I would go. You sort of recognized that you were a soldier, you had taken the oath, you hadn't, you know, it was part of a thing. The civilian authorities made a judgment about what it was, where it was appropriate to serve. Within limits, you would do what you were asked to, you were asked to do. But once it was a question that we're in this together, we're going to deal with it as it comes, then the internal disagreements were okay. But I think something like, there was a massive, when I got out in 72, there was a little, it was even written up in the New York Times about how many officers from the academy left the service in that year. I mean, I had a friend who had the middle, who had the Medal of Honor, who left in that year. He went to work for H. Ross Perot. I had another guy who went off. He was very relatively young. I mean, he was a major, but he was about 37 years of age. He went off to be the president of Hampton Sydney College. No, I don't think he didn't go there first. He went someplace else, like Briarcliff College or something. Then he went off to Hampton Sydney after that. But he left. He had written an anti-war novel based on his experiences with the 9th Division in Vietnam. So there were, you know, it was not the, if you ask an outsider, what was it like to be at West Point, kind of implicit almost in your question was an expectation that, it surely wasn't Berkeley, and it wasn't that. And undoubtedly there were more fellows there who were sort of supporting the U.S. effort and thought the U.S. effort was right in all aspects than would have been typical on any civilian college campus at the time. But there also was a fair amount of debate going on, and in terms of freedom of expression within limits. I mean, you know, I think had somebody counseled resistance that if you get orders to go to Vietnam, don't go, or something like that, or quit the academy, give up your career, that kind of thing, I doubt that that would have been well received. But working within the institution and having debates about what's the most effective role for the Army, are we being used properly, things of that nature, it was pretty free range.
Okay, thank you. So it's at this time, you know, at the end of your third year there, that you then move here.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could talk about the process of, you know, finding out about the position here and then getting the position here.
Well, it was advertised, and my mentor at Columbia recommended that I apply for it. And I don't know, I guess probably would have been around, it must have been a little bit before December of that year. I got this would be of 1971, that I got a call from, it was probably Morth Rothstein, who was the chair at that point, a very nice man, saying, would I be interested, would I come out for an interview? And so I came out in, I think it was early December of that year, and did an interview here, sort of the typical interview of the time, meeting people, talking about what your research was, that kind of stuff. Then I went back to West Point and took probably at least 2 months for it to work out. There were issues, as there always are, about, they told me relatively quickly, within a few weeks, that they'd like to hire me. But then the question becomes, will there be funding available? And they had to do some manipulating in order to get me, you know, defer this or ask for in advance for that, whatever the case may be. I never really found out what all of it was. But once I got here, I understood what it was. There's always this dance with the dean over what money you're going to get for a hire or whatever. But then, let's say around February or so, they made an offer and I accepted it.
So that'd be February 72?
72. And then I was getting out of the Army June 72.
Mm-hmm.
Came out here.
So, besides coming here for the interview, had you been to Madison before?
Never.
So what were your initial impressions, either, you know, during the interview or when you first got here and got settled? So both of Madison and of the campus.
Coming from the East Coast, I had never seen a very large state university. Okay, I had not really been off the East Coast much. I had never been to a large state university. A place like Columbia, which is large enough, but is just, you could probably fit all of the Columbia. Well, maybe not. I guess it's bigger than I think it is, but it's certainly physically not as large as Wisconsin is. I mean, this much New York City real estate would be, you know, probably half the island of Manhattan or something. But not quite, but it does take up it's a lot more spread out here. Columbia would have a lot of buildings, but they'd be very tightly together. There'd be a little bit of grass, but not all that much, and the like. NYU, essentially the same kind of things. These were my ideas of big universities. Later, I heard a story that sort of puts it in perspective. Somebody was talking about how much money Wisconsin brought in, and that they was bringing in more federal dollars than Harvard or something like that. And someone who said something along, you know, how can that possibly be? And the person said, have you ever heard of the Wisconsin School of Agriculture, of the Harvard School of Agriculture? Okay, there are just dimensions to things that they're doing here that you're not typically doing at a non-state university, particularly in the East. So the scale struck me when I got here. I didn't even think that the Humanities building was all that ugly, although I understood it after I got here that was kind of an article of faith that you had to accept. And it is a pretty dysfunctional building, but it's, you know, it's never bothered me all as much as it's bothered some. So I was impressed with that. The other thing that struck me, and this was like my first week or so here, about a friend of mine who teaches at Temple Law School. I had been visiting with him just before I came out here, and we were talking about the 1972 election. And his father had been a Democratic congressman from Chicago. So, I mean, he was not naive about political matters. And we were saying, well, what do you think is the outcome of the election going to be? And we both agreed that it would probably be about 60-40 for Nixon, although both of us were going to vote for McGovern. And I got here and people seemed actually to believe that McGovern was going to win. And I have to admit that has affected my sort of attitude toward Wisconsin for the last 40 years, that there's a certain detachment from reality that, and it's not that I didn't want him to win or anything like that, but there were certain things that were obviously not going to happen. But people were either not grasping that larger reality and just mistaken, or they knew it but were lying in what they thought, and I couldn't figure it out. But it made me terribly skeptical about their skills at being historians. If they were misreading the ground at that level, but so I have to admit that that initial impression was a little bit off-putting, but by and large, I liked it. It was, the people turned out to be good. They are pretty smart people. It was probably the heat of a political contest or whatever that was. People were probably projecting what they wanted rather than what they believed and the like. But
so where did you, at this point, were you married?
Yeah.
Okay. So where did you and your wife decide to live?
Well, we found a place out near Westgate initially. We didn't really want to live out there. We wanted to be closer to campus, and eventually we moved in. We moved in closer, but it was a question of what we could afford, when, and what was available. It was, in fact, I'm surprised that our Army training paid off, because one thing I came to recognize at West Point was the ability of these people who are being transferred every 2 or 3 years. The basic idea is you come into a town, you have, it depends, some Army bases you get housing on the base. That's the, from the military's point of view, the ideal situation. Many situations, there's not enough housing on the base. There wasn't enough housing on base at West Point, and so you got to find housing. At least those who are lower on the totem pole have to find housing off base. And these, at this point, we're talking fellows. I mean, now the West Point faculty, I think the West Point, the head of the history department at West Point, I believe now is a woman. But I mean, these then fellows would come into town. They might have, they, maybe they wouldn't even be in town. They'd be in Vietnam. They'd find out that their next assignment is West Point, because it would be very typical for them, let's say, to go to graduate school 2 years, do a first or a second tour in Vietnam, and then come to West Point. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily lockstep from graduate school to West Point. I mean, that was the logical process, but it wasn't inevitably that that was it, because these fellows are, you know, they're actually on a couple of tracks. I mean, they're trying to get various career tickets punched in their thing, because they're, you know, they're, West Point is going to be, counting graduate school, a 3 to 5 year period and a 20 to 30 year career. And let's say getting command experience in combat is at least as important as teaching at West Point. In fact, teaching at West Point is, to some, it depends. To some extent, it can be a dangerous move in terms of your Army career. It may take you, it may make you, may make people think of you more as a staff officer than as a commander, and that would limit what you could do. So if it were a question of what's more, if you want to become a general, what's more important, to have a role commanding in combat or to have taught at West Point, you would definitely want to have commanded in combat. Now, having commanded in combat and taught at West Point, well, that's the whipped cream and the cherry on top. That's David Petraeus, okay? Mm-hmm. Petraeus is one of the guys who goes through the social sciences department at West Point. Mm-hmm. And Petraeus was a student when I was there. I never was in contact with him, but he married the daughter of the guy who was the superintendent at the time. The superintendent is the equivalent of the chancellor here. So I mean, but he is a kind of, he is a very typical, not very typical, he's a very untypical man, but he's a very, he's perhaps the ideal social science graduate. I mean, the guy who does all the command thing, who can be 60 years of age doing push-ups and the like, and who has a PhD or whatever he has in whatever field and has taught at West Point. You know, that's the sort of the golden standard for a social science department member. But the fact that he was a real soldier is just as important. Well, in any case, these fellows might be in Vietnam. They hear the next appointment is at West Point. And so the wife gets sent to West Point, find us a house. You know, so go there 2 days, find a house. These people are mission-oriented, and that's what happened. We left our kids with Marilyn's parents. We came out here. We had a couple of days. We found a house. It wasn't ideal. It wasn't exactly what we wanted, but mission accomplished. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we were unhappy with the house for 5 years. Mm-hmm. It was a utilitarian house. It was fine. No big problem with it, but it then gave us time to look for something a little bit closer to campus in an area we liked a little bit better. So, mm-hmm. But it was, you know, typical.
So where was that second house?
In the Vilas Park neighborhood. So. Okay. And we've been there since 1977.
A couple more things today. The difference, I'm going to assume, and it's, you know, I think you sort of debunked my assumption when I asked it earlier, but I'll ask it in this way. The difference between teaching at West Point and then coming here and teaching at Madison, maybe starting with the idea of the students that you were teaching.
Well, the students, I would say there's probably, now, of course, it's hard to say what West Point is like now, for example. I haven't been back there in a number of years, but comparing the students at the time, I had the appearance, the sense that, let's say, in terms of political outlook and background and the like, the students at West Point were a little bit more homogeneous than they would be here. I mean, they're fairly homogeneous here. And it's not that West Point had, it has much more now. I mean, there was no women there at the time. Now they have a substantial number of women. There were minority students there at the time. I believe there's more there now, but it wasn't that it was it was an all male, but certainly not lily white institution at the time. But the kids were all conventional. If they were rebellious, they were modestly rebellious. They were more inclined toward prankishness than political theater. They were very hardworking. They were very well organized. They probably didn't have enough time to themselves. Their days were extraordinarily full, lots of demands on them. I think part of the training was to overwork them and to put them under tremendous pressure and force them to sort out what was important and what was not important. Now, I'm not saying the kids here are not under those pressures, but they probably have more unsupervised time than those fellows did. There's probably, more radical thinkers here, and I don't mean necessarily just radical left. I mean people who will break molds more. You know, they just are. If you're a free spirit, you're probably more likely to come to a place like this than you would be to go to a place like West Point, where you are, in effect, joining an institution, an organization, okay, Okay, so that's it. I think one thing that always struck me a little bit about, I have conflicted values about it still. The teachers at West Point, those guys who were there for like 2-3 years and then rotated out, often I thought of them as, not that I was much more advanced at the time, I wasn't, but I thought of them as essentially, and especially after I came here and had the different perspective, because at Columbia you didn't rely on TAs very much. But it struck me that these guys were essentially TAs teaching. It was primarily a TA taught school. There would be a couple of people in the department who had PhDs. And they usually were in administrative positions and didn't teach. There was the head of the department, and then there was the person who was the deputy head of the department, who was known there as the not head. So you had the head and the not head. And I think they were aware of the pun. But then most of the other people had not had more than 2 years, maybe 3 years of graduate school under their belt when they started teaching. Some of them finished degrees while they were there. Maybe I could be put myself in that in that category, but I'm thinking more of the military guys. Some of them finished there or finished them subsequently, continued on with them and finished them. So I'm not saying they weren't smart and the like, but they were relatively inexperienced faculty. And they had a lot of energy and the like, but you'd wonder about the depth of education. You didn't have at least people who had built up a tremendous store of knowledge based on 20 or 30 years worth of work during the teaching. On the other hand, these fellows had some very real world experience. They had often met very powerful people. They had been given tremendous amounts of responsibility at young ages. Certainly would prove them capable. And I've been torn back and forth as to, I think there was a certain real value there in having that kind of teacher, in the sense that a place like West Point could very easily become disrespectful, or at least not respectful, if not disrespectful. It could lack respect for non-military learning, or for the impractical knowledge. And the school was very much against that. That was not the values they wanted to teach. In fact, recently, when Governor Walker made his pronouncements about UW, one of our faculty members, who is a U.S. MA graduate who taught at West Point, John Hall, wrote a very interesting letter to the, a public letter to the legislature, and it was published in the Milwaukee Journal, in which he emphasizes how much the military and West Point, for example, how much importance they put on the liberal arts and social sciences and the like, and in continuing education, and that, you know, there's always a tension at West Point. Are you training a second lieutenant, or are you training a general? Okay. And I think the cadets, when they come in, are thinking in terms of being second lieutenants. You know, teach me how to lead the platoon, teach me how to do this, teach me how to do that. And the Army is saying, in effect, well, we're not having, we can get that any place. What we want is to start building people who are going to be potentially world leaders. And it requires and it requires more. And then having a faculty who are not sort of desiccated academics who have never fired a weapon or had somebody shoot at them in anger, teach them, you know, they're wary of that. They'd rather have a guy who has a Medal of Honor saying, history is important to me, okay? And, or economics is important to me, or whatever. And it's not a question, not many people have Medal of Honors, but you, and you see these guys who, you know, there are different types. There are guys who wear their ribbons, there are guys who don't wear the ribbon. The fellow who had the Medal of Honor never wore ribbons. Okay. He just was he, you know. But these guys all had Purple Hearts, they all had Bronze Stars, some of them had Silver Stars. They all had combat infantry badges or equivalents. They were, you know, they were the real deal. They were very, you know, there were a few jerks, but most of them were pretty admirable people. And I think there was a value in that. Academically, when I was there, I was thinking, my God, this is, you know, is this a college? In terms of the level of the depth of the courses, it wasn't in that regard. Maybe at the end. I mean, now I think it's been improved, not improved a little bit, but it's changed. It's become more subtle. I think they have more civilian teachers now. I'm not sure whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. I suppose, because I haven't really followed it closely, I think having some probably allows them to build a little bit more depth into it. They have visiting professors come in for a year to do something. They do have some senior courses or senior paper where people are getting more depth of training. So I think over time it has evolved. But the core system, I think, is still fairly similar, and it's not without virtue. It has probably some downsides, but it has some upsides as well.
Tom, I think I... Do you have a watch on that computer?
Yeah, I'm sure I do. I know I do, actually. I just got to get it to come up. This is a very slow... I'm guessing it's
past three. Just past three.
1 minute past right, three.
So I have time. If there's anything else you want to add about what we've been talking about, I want to give you some space for that.
Oh, you mentioned after. Why did I go back? Yeah, I remember in your list of questions.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period of time where this reserve commitment that I had, like the 2 weeks, sort of reserve duty that members of the reserve did. Well, my 2 weeks was going back to West Point in the summer, doing 2 weeks there, advising them on curriculum or something. The expectation was that if there had been a serious mobilization where, you know, they needed their people to go wherever, and they needed to pull West Point faculty to do it, that they could call me back. They called me a mobilization designee. So it would be a question there. Now, I stopped doing that, not entirely voluntarily. It was that they wanted me also to do stuff like do my adjutant general, continue my adjutant general correspondence courses. And I never bothered with that. And so when it got to my end of my obligation for the reserve, the Army, you know, either wanted me, they weren't happy with the progress I was making with the adjutant general make work projects, and I was not willing to spend more time on them. I mean, I think I probably would have been better off had they said, you know, we'll send you to another armor school for 6 months or something like that. I was, during the course of the academic year, I was doing my research, doing whatever it was here, and here was stupid things filling out, you know, do I want to take machine tests on, you know, how you fill out some personnel form or something like that. So I did a few of those things, but I never kept up to pace with them. So the Army either wanted me to get serious about doing this or not to continue, and I decided not to continue with that.
So that
ended. But essentially, I was doing that. I liked it up there. I mean, heck, I would have probably stayed up there if they let me. But on the other hand, it was time to go, and that was it. It was over, and that was it.
Okay. Well, Tom, I want to thank you again for your time. So this concludes the second interview with Thomas Archdeacon.
Okay. There's nothing for me to say.